Besides, I hated school, too. All I did was smoke dope. I leaned toward him. Now, can I ask you one?
Sure.
How did you and Vera meet? He was almost imperceptibly disconcerted, shifting slightly in his seat.
A mutual friend introduced us a couple of months ago. We've been seeing each other ever since. Just as friends, of course. Nothing serious.
Oh, yeah, right, I said. So what do you think?
About Vera? She's terrific.
How come you're sitting here with me, then? He laughed again, a false, hearty roar that avoided a reply. I'm serious, I said. His smile cooled down by degrees. He still wasn't addressing the issue, so I tried it myself. You know what I think it is? I got the impression she had the hots for you herself and didn't know how to handle it. He gave me a look like I was speaking in tongues.
I have a hard time believing that, he said.
He thought about it for a moment.
Anyway, she's a bit tall for me, don't you think?
Not at all. You look great together. I was watching when you came in. He gave his head a slight shake.
I know it bothers her. She's never actually come out and said so, but she'll get over it. You think so?
Does it bother you?
Not a bit.
Then what's the problem? He looked at me. His face was beginning to appeal to me. His eyes held a nice light, conveying qualities of sincerity and confidence. He was probably the kind of doctor you could call at 2 o'clock a.m., a man who'd sit up with your kid until the fever broke. I was about to hike up my pant leg and show him my bruise, but it seemed kind of gross. You should hear the way she talks about you, I went on. 8.5 on a scale of 10. That's how she describes you, I swear to God.
Are you kidding?
Neil, come on. I wouldn't kid about that. She's completely smitten with you. She just hasn't figured it out yet. Now he laughed, the kind of laugh that made his whole face light up. A boyish pleasure showed through, and I could swear he blushed. He was really kind of cute. I glanced up in time to see Vera shoot me a stark look. I gave her a little finger wave and turned my attention back to him. I mean, what the hell are relationships about? I asked.
But she's never given any indication.
Well, I'm telling you for a fact. I've known her for ages, and I've never heard her talk about a guy the way she talks about you. He was taking it in, but I could tell he wasn't buying it. How tall are you? I said. You don't look short to me.
5'7".
She's only 5'9". What's the big deal? Mac Voorhees tapped on his glass with a spoon about then, saying,
Ladies and gentlemen, if I may have your attention.
He and Marie had been placed at table 2, near the center of the room. Jewel and her husband were at the same table, and I could see Jewel begin to squirm, anticipating the speech to come. Macklin Voorhees is one of the California Fidelity vice presidents, lean and humorless, with sparse, flyaway white hair and a perpetual cigar clamped between his teeth. He's smart and fair-minded, honorable, conservative, ill-tempered sometimes, but a very capable executive. The notion of being publicly praised by this man had already brought the color to Jewel's face. The room gradually quieted. Mac took a moment to survey the crowd.
We're here tonight to pay homage to one of the finest women I've ever been privileged to work with. As you all know, Jewel Cavalletto is retiring from the company after 25 years of service.
There's something hypnotic about the tone and tenor of an after-dinner speech. Maybe because everyone's full of food and wine and the room's too warm by then. I was sitting there feeling grateful that Mac had bypassed the canned humor and was getting straight to the point. I don't know what made me look at the door. Everyone else was looking at Mac. I caught something out of the corner of my eye and turned my head. It was the kid. I blinked uncomprehendingly at first, as if confronted with a mirage. Then I felt a rush of fear. The only clear glimpse I'd ever had of him was that first encounter at the rest stop. Mark Messenger had been feigning sleep that day, stretched out on a bench with a magazine across his face, while Eric knelt on the pavement with his matchbox car, making mouth noises, shifting gears with his voice. I'd seen him again one night in the motel parking lot, his features indistinguishable in the poorly lighted alcove where his father had taken him to buy a soft drink. I'd heard his laughter echo through the darkness, an impish peal that reminded me of the shadowy underworld of elves and fairies. The last time I'd seen him, his face had been partially obscured behind the paper sticker on the passenger side of the truck in which his father tried to run me down. He was small for 5. The light in the corridor glinted on his blonde head. His hair was getting long. His eyes were pinned on me, and a half-smile played on his mouth. He turned to look at someone standing in the corridor just out of sight. He was being prompted, like a kid acting an unfamiliar part in the grade school play. I could see him say, "What?" I didn't wait to see what the next line would be. I grabbed my handbag and came up out of my seat, nearly knocking my chair over in the process. Dietz turned to look at me and caught the direction of my startled gaze. By the time he checked the entrance, it was empty. I bolted around Neil's chair, heading toward the hall, tagging Dietz's arm. "It's the kid," I hissed. His gun came out and he grabbed my arm, jerking me along behind him as he moved toward the door. Matt caught the commotion and stopped mid-sentence, looking up at us in astonishment. Other people turned to see what was going on. Some woman emitted a startled cry at the sight of Dietz's 45, but by then he'd reached the entrance and had flattened himself against the wall. He peered around the doorway to the right, glanced left, and drew back. "Come on," he said. Still propelling me by the arm, he walk-raced us down the corridor to the left, our footsteps thudding on the tiled surface. I half expected him to stash me in Vera's room while he ran reconnaissance, but instead he steered us toward the exit at the end of the hall. At the door we stopped again abruptly while he made sure there was no one out there. The night air hit us like icy water after the warmth of the banquet room. We eased away from the light, hugging the shrubs as we rounded the corner, moving toward the parking lot.
"You're sure it was him?" he asked, his tone low.
"Of course I'm sure."
We were on a darkened walkway that bordered one of the interior courtyards. Crickets were chirring, and I could smell the slightly skunky scent of marigolds. Voices up ahead. Dietz drew us into the shelter of some hibiscus bushes bunched against the building. I was clutching the Davis, my hand shoved down in the outside pocket of my shoulder bag. Dietz's fingers dug painfully into the flesh of my right arm, but that was the only indication I had of how tense he was. A couple passed, 2 of the bridesmaids I'd seen earlier. I could hear their long taffeta skirts rustle as they hurried by.
"Just what I need, a guy equipped with a 4X," one was saying.
"Hey, come on, he's buff," the other said, voices fading as they turned through the archway to our left.
Dietz moved out onto the walkway, keeping me close.
"We'll check the parking lot," he murmured. "I want to make sure the guy's not out there waiting for us."
There was a scattering of guests at the hotel entrance, waiting for their cars to be brought around by 3 white-jacketed valets who had spread out at a trot across the parking lot. The immediate area was washed by a wide spill of light. The windows along the wing to our left formed tall rectangles of yellow, casting soft oblongs of illumination on the grass below. Banana palms intersected the light source at intervals. To our right, against the darkness, a thick cluster of birds of paradise was highlighted in blue and green outdoor spots that made them look like a flock of beaky fowl staring intently into the middle distance. A car eased out of the driveway and turned right, headlights flashing across the upright supports of the seawall. The ocean beyond was a pounding presence limned in moonlight. The back end of Dietz's red Porsche was in plain view, parked close to the line of shrubs that bordered the circular drive. Dietz motioned for the night scope, which I dug out of my handbag. He held the scope to his eye, scanning the grounds.
"Here, you look," he murmured, and handed me the device.
I peered through the scope, startled by the sudden eerie green clarity of the landscape. Where the black had seemed dense and impenetrable, there was now a fine haze of green, with objects outlined in neon. The kid was crouching in a thicket of ferns beside a palm tree. He was sitting on his heels, arms wrapped around his bony knees, which were bared in shorts. While I was watching, he lifted his head, peering toward the entrance, perhaps in hopes of catching sight of us. His young body conveyed all the tension of a game of hide-and-seek. I didn't see Messenger, but he had to be somewhere close. I touched Dietz's arm and pointed. He took the scope and scanned again.
"Got him,"
he murmured. He checked with his naked eye and then again with the scope. Without a word, we retreated, retracing our steps. We circled the main building, slipping into the hotel through a service entrance at the rear.
Dietz used one of a bank of wall phones near the kitchen to call a cab, which picked us up on a side street behind the hotel minutes later.
Chapter 18.
By the time we got home, it was nearly 11 o'clock, and Dietz was in a foul mood. He'd been silent in the cab, silent as he unlocked the door and let us in. Impatiently, he stripped off his jacket. The right sleeve got hung up on his cufflink. He jerked it free, wadded the jacket up, and flung it across the room, ignoring the fact that it didn't go that far. He went into the kitchenette, opened the bottle of Jack Daniels, and poured himself a jelly glass of whiskey, which he tossed down. I picked up the jacket from the floor and folded it across my arm.
"It's not your fault," I said.
"The fuck it's not," he snapped. "I was the one who insisted we go tonight. It was stupid, way too risky. And for what? Messenger could have walked in there with an Uzi and mowed us all down."
Actually, it was hard to argue that one, as the same thing had occurred to me.
"What happened?"
"Nothing happened." He reached for a cigarette, but caught himself abruptly.
"I'm going out," he said.
"And leave me here by myself?" I yelped.
He flashed a dark look at me. His fingers tightened on the glass until I half expected him to crush it in his grip. Something about the gesture made my temper climb.
"Oh, for God's sake, just cut it out, okay? The guy's showing off again. Big deal. He wants me nervous, and he wants you kicking your own butt. Well, so far, so good. You storm out to buy a pack of cigarettes, and he can step in and finish me off without any interference. Thanks a lot."
He was silent for a moment. He set the glass aside and leaned, stiff-armed, against the counter, head down.
"You're right."
"Damn right I'm right," I said peevishly. "Lighten up and let's figure out some way to kill his ass. I hate chicken shit guys trying to shoot me. Let's get him first."
That gave his mood a lift.
"How?"
"I don't know how."
There was a knock at the door and both of us jumped. Dietz whipped his gun out and motioned me into the kitchenette. He crossed to the front door and flattened himself against the wall to the right.
"Who is it?"
The voice was muffled.
"Clyde Gersh."
I moved toward the door, but Dietz waved me back with a scowl. He tilted his head against the doorframe.
"What do you want?"
"Agnes was picked up. She's in the emergency room at St. Terry's, and she's asking for Kinsey. We left a couple of messages on the answering machine, but when we didn't hear back, we thought we'd stop by. We're on our way to the hospital. Is she home yet?"
Dietz said,
"Hang on."
He pointed to the answering machine, which rested on the bookshelf behind the sofa. I eased across the room and checked the message light, which indicated that two calls had been recorded. I turned the volume down, pushed the auto playback button, and listened to the tape. The first message was from Irene, the second from Clyde, both saying much the same thing. Agnes had been found and was asking for me. Dietz and I exchanged a look. He lifted his brows in a facial shrug. He flipped the porch light on, peered through the spy hole, and opened the door with caution. Clyde was standing by himself on the doorstep in a circle of wan light. Beyond him all was darkness. The fog was rolling in, and I could see faint wisps of it curling around the light.
"Sorry for the inconvenience," he said. "I don't like to disturb people this late, but Irene insisted."
"Come on in," Dietz said,
stepping back so Clyde could enter. Dietz closed the door behind him and motioned Clyde to have a seat, an offer Clyde declined with a brief shake of his head.
"Irene's waiting in the car. I don't want to leave her too long. She's anxious to get over there."
He was looking weary, his baggy face weighted with anxiety. He wore a tan gabardine topcoat, hands shoved down in his pockets. His gaze flickered across Dietz's holster, but he refrained from comment, as if mentioning the gun might be a breach of etiquette.
"How's Agnes doing? Has anybody said?" I asked.
"We're not really sure. The doc says minor cuts and bruises, nothing serious. But her heart beats irregular, and I guess they put her on some kind of monitor. She'll be admitted as soon as we sign the paperwork. I gather it's nothing life-threatening, but the woman is 80-some-odd years old."
"The cops picked her up?"
Clyde nodded.
"Some woman spotted her, wandering in the street. She was the one who called the police. The officer who called said Agnes is disoriented, has no idea where she is or where she's been all this time.
The doc says she's been talking about you since they brought her in. We'd appreciate your coming with us if it's not too much trouble. I said, sure, let me change my clothes. I don't want to go like this. I'll let Irene know you're coming, he said to me. And then to Dietz, will you follow in your car or ride with us?
We'll come in your car and grab a cab back, Dietz said.
I was on my way up to the loft, stripping off the black silk jacket as I went, kicking off my shoes. I leaned my head out over the railing. Where'd they find her? Clyde turned his face up to mine with a shrug.
Same neighborhood as the nursing home, somewhere close by, so she didn't get far. I can't figure out how we missed her unless she saw us and hid.
I wouldn't put it past her, I ducked back, peeling off the jumpsuit, hopping on one foot as I tugged my jeans on over the black pantyhose. I put a bra on, grabbed a polo shirt out of the chest of drawers, pulled it on, and shook my hair out. I stepped into my high-top Reeboks and left the laces for later. I was clopping down the narrow staircase 2 seconds later, reaching for my shoulder bag. Let's hit it, I said, as Dietz opened the door. Clyde's white Mercedes sedan was parked at the curb. Irene, in the front, turned a worried face toward us as we approached. The 15-minute drive to St. Terry's was strained. Dietz and I sat in the back seat, with Dietz angled sideways so he could check out the back window for any cars following. I was perched, leaning forward, arms resting on the front seat close to Irene, who clutched my hand as if it were a lifeline. Her fingers were icy, and I found myself listening unconsciously for the wheezing that might signal another asthma attack. No one said much. The information about Agnes was limited, and there didn't seem to be any point in repeating it. The small parking lot in front of the emergency room was full. A black and white occupied the end slot. Clyde pulled up to the entrance and let us out, then went off to find parking on the street. Irene hung back, evidently reluctant to go on without him. She wore a lightweight spring coat, double-breasted, bright red, which she pulled around her now as if for warmth. I could see her peering off toward the streetlights, hoping to catch sight of him. "He'll be with us shortly," I said. She clung to my arm while Dietz brought up the rear. The double door slid open automatically as we approached. We passed into the reception area, which was deserted as far as I could tell. I was struck by the silence. Somehow I'd expected activity, urgency, some sense of the medical drama that plays out in every ER. Patients with broken bones, puncture wounds, cuts, insect bites, allergic reactions, and superficial burns. Here the rooms felt empty, and there was no indication of acute care of any sort. Perhaps it was the hour. Perhaps an unpredictable lull in the ordinary course of events. Irene and I waited at the curved front counter, a C-shape enclosing a desk papered with forms. To our immediate right were two patient registration windows, shuttered at this hour. On our left there was a room divider with two payphones on the near side and a waiting area beyond. I could see a color television set, tuned to a news show, the sound too low to register. Everything was done in muted blues and grays. All was in order, tidy, and quiet. Through an open doorway, I caught a glimpse of the nurse's station, ringed by examining rooms. There was no sign of the police officer or hospital personnel. Dietz was restless, snapping his fingers against the palm of his hand. He ambled over to the interior door and peered in, checking the layout, automatically eyeballing avenues of escape in case messenger showed up again. The receptionist must have spotted him because she emerged from the rear moments later, smiling at us politely.
"Sorry to keep you waiting. How may I help you?"
"We're here to see Agnes Gray," I said.
She was a woman in her 40s, wearing ordinary street clothes. Polyester pants, cotton sweater, rubber-soled shoes, a stethoscope, like a pendant, dangled from her neck. Her eyes were a rich chocolate brown, lending warmth to her face. She checked some papers on her desk and then looked up at Irene.
"Are you Mrs. Gersh?"
"That's right," Irene said.
The woman's tone was pleasant, but I could see her smile falter. Her attitude suggested the carefully controlled neutrality you'd merit if the actual test results were not what you'd been led to expect.
"Why don't you come on back and have a seat in the office?" she said. "The doctor will be right with you."
Irene blinked at her fearfully, her voice close to a whisper.
I'd like to see Mother. Is she all right?
Dr. Stackhouse would prefer to talk to you first, she said. Would you like to follow me, please?
I didn't like it. Her manner was entirely too kindly and benign. She could have made any one of a number of responses. Maybe she'd been advised not to discuss medical matters. Maybe she'd been chastised for offering her opinion before the doctor could offer his. Maybe hospital policy forbade her to editorialize about the patient's condition for complicated reasons of liability. Or maybe Agnes Gray was dead. The woman glanced at me.
Your daughter's welcome to come with you.
You want me to come? I asked.
Yes, please,
Irene said to me. Then to the receptionist,
My husband's parking the car. Will you tell him where we are?
Dietz spoke up. I'll let him know. You two go on back. We'll be right there. Irene murmured a thank you. Dietz and I exchanged a look. The receptionist stood by the open door while we passed through. She led the way while we followed along a corridor with high-gloss white flooring. She showed us into an office evidently used by any doctor on duty.
It won't be long. Can I get you anything? Coffee? A cup of tea?
Irene shook her head.
This is fine.
We sat down in blue tweed chairs with upholstered seats. There were no exterior windows. The Formica shelf desk was bare. There was a gray leather couch showing doctor-size indentations in the cushions. As an impromptu daybed, it was slightly too short, and I could see where his shoes had scraped against the arm at one end. A white Formica bookcase was filled with standard medical texts. The potted plant was fake, a Swedish ivy made of paper with curling vines as stiff as florist's wire. The only pictures on the wall looked like reproductions from Grey's Anatomy. Personally, I can do without all the skinless arms and legs. The saphenous vein and its branches looked like an overview of the Los Angeles freeway system. Irene shrugged her coat off and smoothed the lap of her skirt.
I can't believe there weren't any papers to fill out. They must have admitted her.
You know hospitals. They have their own way of doing things.
Clyde has the insurance information in his wallet. Blue Cross, I think, though I'm not sure she's covered.
Bill the nursing home, I said. It's their responsibility. We sat for a moment, saying nothing. I wondered if this was what it felt like to have family. Geriatric crises, accompanied by homely discussions about what should be done with Granny. We heard footsteps in the hall, and the doctor came into the room. I was half expecting the receptionist with Clyde and Dietz in tow, so it took me a second to compute the expression on this guy's face. He was in his early 30s, with carrot-colored curly hair and a ruddy complexion. He was wearing an unstructured cotton shirt in a hospital green, V-neck, short sleeves, matching cotton pants, soft-soled, baggy shoes. He had a stethoscope around his neck and a white plastic name tag that read, Warren Stackhouse, M.D. With his red hair and freckles, the surgical greens gave him a certain technicolor vibrancy, like a cartoon character. He smelled like adhesive tape and breath mints, and his hands looked freshly scrubbed. He was holding a manila folder, which contained only one sheet. He placed that on the desk, lining up the edges.
Mrs. Gersh, I'm Dr. Stackhouse.
He and Irene shook hands, and then he leaned against the desk.
I'm afraid we lost her.
Oh, for God's sake, Irene snapped. Can't anybody keep track of her?
Uh-oh, I thought. Irene wasn't getting it.
I don't think he means it that way, I murmured.
Mrs. Gray went into cardiac arrest, he said. I'm sorry. We did everything we could, but we weren't able to revive her.
Irene grew still, her face blank, her tone of voice nearly petulant.
Are you saying she's dead? But that's impossible. She couldn't be. You've made some mistake. Clyde said her injuries were minor, cuts and bruises. I thought he talked to you.
I was watching the doctor, and I could see him pick his words with care.
When she was first brought in, she was already showing symptoms of cardiac arrhythmia. She was confused and disoriented, suffering from exposure and stress. In a woman her age, given her fragile state of health...
Irene let out a sigh, finally taking it in.
Oh, the poor thing!
Her eyes filled with sudden tears, which spilled down her cheeks. Blotches of color had come up in her face and neck. She began to tremble uncontrollably, quivering like a wet dog in the midst of a bath. I grabbed her hand. Clyde appeared in the doorway. From the look in his eyes, he'd been told what was going on. The receptionist had probably informed him as soon as he came in. Irene turned beseechingly.
"Clyde, Mother's gone," she said.
She reached for him, coming out of the chair and into his arms. He seemed to fold her in against him. For the first time I realized how tiny she was. I looked away, not wanting to intrude on their intimacy. I saw Dietz through the open doorway, leaning against the wall. His posture was identical to my first sight of him. Cowboy boots, his tweed coat. The hospital down in Brawley. All he needed was the toothbrush in his pocket, sticking up like a fountain pen. His gaze moved casually to mine, moved to Irene, came back to mine and held. The look in his eyes was quizzical, perplexed. His expression shifted from self-assurance to uncertainty. I felt an unexpected flash of heat. I broke off eye contact, feeling flushed. My gaze drifted back. He was still looking at me, with a wistfulness I hadn't seen before. We all waited uncomfortably for Irene's tears to pass. Finally, Dr. Stackhouse moved toward the door, and I followed. The two of us withdrew, moving out into the corridor. As we walked back to the emergency room, Dietz fell into step with us, placing his hand on the back of my neck in a way that made me feel curious and alert. It was a gesture of possession, and the physical connection was charged with a sudden current that made the air between us hum. Dr. Stackhouse shook his head.
"God, I'm sorry. It was a lousy break. Are you her granddaughter? Someone's going to have to talk to the police officer."
I focused on the situation as if coming up for air. "I'm a friend of Mrs. Gersh's, Kinsey Milhone," I said. He glanced at me.
"The one she was asking for."
"So I'm told," I said. "Do you have any idea what it was?"
"Well, I can tell you what she said, but I don't think it means much. She kept saying it was summer. Tell her it used to be summer. Is that significant?"
"Not to me," I said. In her mind, it was probably connected to the long, rambling tale she'd told me down at the desert. Emily and the earthquake, the Harpster girls, and Arthur James. "That's all she said?"
"That's the only thing I heard."
"Will there be an autopsy?"
"Probably. We put a call through to the coroner's office, and a deputy's on the way. He'll talk to the pathologist and decide if it's warranted."
"Which pathologist? Dr. Yee or Dr. Palchak?"
"Dr. Palchak," he said. "Of course, the deputy may just go ahead and authorize us to sign the death certificate."
"What about Agnes? Can we see her?" He nodded.
"Of course. She's just down the hall here. Whenever Mrs. Gersh is ready, the nurse will take you in."
Agnes had been moved temporarily to a little used examining room at the end of the hall. Once we were gone, she'd be wheeled down to the basement and left in the refrigerated darkness of the morgue. Dietz waited in the hall with Clyde while Irene and I stood silently beside the gurney on which her mother lay. Death had smoothed many of the lines from her face. Under the white sheeting, she seemed small and frail, her beaky nose protruding prominently from the peaceful folds of her face. There was a discreet knock at the door. A young uniformed police officer came into the room and introduced himself. He'd brought Agnes in, and he talked to Irene briefly about his encounter with her mother.
"She seemed like a very nice person, ma'am. I just thought you might like to know she didn't give me any trouble."
Irene's eyes brimmed.
"Thank you. I appreciate that. Was she in pain? I can't stand to think about what she must have gone through."
"No, ma'am, I wouldn't say so. She might have been confused, but she didn't seem to be in pain or anything like that."
"Thank God for that. Did she ask for me?"
Color tinted his cheeks.
"I couldn't say for sure. I know she mentioned somebody named Sheila."
"Sheila?" Irene said blankly.
"I'm pretty sure that was it. She did cry some. She said she was sorry to be a bother. I kept talking to her, telling her everything was fine. She quieted down after that and seemed all right till we got her here." I know the staff did everything possible to save her. I guess sometimes they just go like that.
Irene's chin began to quiver. She pressed a handkerchief to her mouth while she shook her head, whispering,
I had no idea she was dying. My God, if we'd only hurried, we might have been here in time.
The officer shifted uneasily.
I'll step out in the waiting room and finish filling out my report. I believe the sheriff's deputy's out there now. He'll need some information as soon as you're up to it.
He moved out into the hall, leaving the door ajar. After a moment, Clyde came in. He put his arm around Irene's shoulder and walked her out toward the reception area. Before the door closed again, I caught a glimpse of the sheriff's deputy in the corridor, conferring with his STPD counterpart. I gathered the city police had reported the death to the county coroner's office, since Agnes was listed as missing, and the last hours of her life were still unaccounted for. The coroner would make a determination as to the circumstances, manner, and cause of death. If she should be classified as a homicide victim, the city police would assume responsibility for the criminal investigation. I was guessing the death would be considered non-reportable in coroner's terms, but that remained to be seen. An autopsy might be done in any event. Alone with the body, I lifted one corner of the sheet, reaching for the cool, unyielding flesh of Agnes's left hand. Her knuckles were scraped. Two nails were broken. On her ring finger and her pinky, there was soil impacted under the nails. The receptionist came into the room behind me. I slipped her hand under the sheet again and turned.
Yes? Mr. Gersh said to tell you he's taking his wife out to the car. The other gentleman is waiting.
What happened to her personal effects?
There wasn't much. Dr. Stackhouse set aside the articles of clothing for disposition by the coroner. She didn't have anything else with her when she was brought in.
I scribbled a note to Dr. Palchak, asking her to call me. I left the message with the ER nurse as I passed the desk. Dietz wanted to call a cab, but Clyde insisted on dropping us back at my place. Irene cried inconsolably all the way home. I was grateful when Dietz finally unlocked the door and let us in. In the back seat of the Mercedes, he'd placed his hand beside mine, our little fingers touching in a way that made me feel my whole left side had been magnetized.
Chapter 19. The minute I was inside, I headed for the loft, too exhausted to bother with social niceties.
You want a glass of wine? He said.
I hesitated. I looked back at him, caught in mid-flight. I had one foot on the bottom step, my hand on the curved railing of the spiral staircase.
I don't think so, thanks.
There was a pause. He said,
Are you all right?
We were suddenly talking in ways that felt unfamiliar, as if each exchange had a hidden meaning. His face seemed the same, but there was something new in his eyes. Where before his gaze had been opaque, there was now an appeal, some request he couldn't quite bring himself to voice. Sexuality stirred the air like the blades of a fan. Exhaustion fell away. All the danger, all the tension had been converted into this mute longing. I could feel the lick of it along my legs, seeping through my clothes. Something ancient, something dark, humankind's only antidote to death. The heat seemed to arc through the space between us like a primitive experiment born of night. This is what I understood. This man was like me, my twin, and suddenly I knew that what I saw in him was a strange reflection of myself. My bravery, my competence, my fear of dependency. I'd been with him 3 days, separated by externals, neutered by survival instincts. Only desire could render us brave enough to cross that distance. But which of us would risk it? I watched him lock the door. I watched him flick the lights out and cross the room. I started up the spiral staircase, turning at the third step. I held the railing, sank into a sitting position as he approached. Dietz was before me, his face level with mine. The room behind him was dark. Light spilled down from the loft, illuminating his solemn face. He leaned into the kiss, his mouth cold at first, his lips soft.
My craving for him was as tangible as a finger of heat driven up through my core. I was lying on the stairs, metal risers cutting into my back until pain and desire had blended into a single sensation. I stroked his cheek, touched the silky strands of his hair, while he buried his face against me, nuzzling my breasts through my cotton t-shirt. We moved together in mock intercourse, clothes on, bodies arching. I could hear the sound of fabric on fabric, his breathing, mine. I reached down and touched him. He made an inhuman sound, lifting away from me, pulling me after him as he moved up the spiral staircase. The bed was better, and we undressed by degrees as we kissed. The first shock of heat when he laid his naked flesh along mine made him say, "Oh, sweet Jesus," very softly. After that there were no words, until the moment of oblivion. Making love with this man was like no other lovemaking I've experienced. Some external chord resolved at its peak, ageless music resonating through our bones, the spilling of secrets, flesh on flesh, moment after moment until we were fused. I fell into a deep sleep, my limbs wound into his, and never knew a waking until daylight came. At 6 o'clock I stirred, vaguely aware that I was alone in bed. I could hear Dietz moving around downstairs. He had the radio on, and I caught strains of a Tammy Wynette tune, poignant enough to rip your heart out. For once, I didn't care. At some point, the doorbell rang. The UPS man, a real one, with the box I'd shipped up from Brawley. Dietz took delivery, as I was still dead to the world. Soon after that, the smell of perking coffee wafted up the stairs. I roused myself, made my bed, fumbled my way into the bathroom, and brushed my teeth. I showered, washed my hair, and then got dressed, slipping into the jeans and shirt I'd worn the night before. No point in contributing either to the laundry pile just yet. I went downstairs. Dietz was perched on a bar stool at the counter, the paper open in front of him, empty juice glass and cereal bowl pushed to one side so he could read. He reached a hand back. I put my arms around him from behind. He kissed me with a mouth so fresh I could taste the cereal.
"You okay?" he asked.
"Yes. You?"
Your package arrived."
The box was sitting just inside the door, addressed to me in my own writing. "Have you inspected this for incendiary devices?" His tone was dry.
"It's clear. Go ahead."
I got a paring knife from the kitchen drawer and slit the strapping tape. The articles were packed as I remembered them, my all-purpose dress close to the surface. I pulled it out and inspected it, relieved to find it in better shape than I'd hoped. It was only moderately encrusted with mold, though it did smell of swamp gas, a scent that hovered somewhere between spoiled eggs and old toilet bowls. Dietz caught one whiff and turned to me, his face twisted with distaste.
"What is that? Good God!"
"This is my best dress," I said. "I just need to throw it in the wash and it'll be fine." I set it aside and worked my way through the remaining contents, removing tools and other odds and ends. In the bottom was the child's tea set, still packed in the carton I'd pulled from under Agnes Gray's trailer. "I should drop this off at Irene's," I remarked, placing the carton near the door. There were few, if any, personal items left to commemorate Agnes Gray's 83 years on Earth, and I thought Irene might appreciate the articles. Dietz looked up from his paper.
"Which reminds me, Dr. Palchak called at 7:30 this morning with the autopsy results. She wanted you to call her whenever you got up."
"That was fast."
"That's what I thought. She says she likes to get in at 5 when she's got a post."
I dialed the number for St. Terry's and asked for pathology. I dealt with Laura Palchak maybe twice before. She's short, plain, heavy-set, competent, hard-working, thorough, and very smart. One of several pathologists under contract to the county, handling post-mortem examinations for the coroner's office.
"Palchak," she said when she came on the line.
"Hi, Laura. Kinsey Milhone. Thanks for responding to my note. What's the story on Agnes Gray?" There was a brief pause.
"The coroner's office will be contacting Mrs. Gersh a little later this morning, so this is just between us, okay?"
"Absolutely."
"The autopsy was negative. We won't have the toxi results back for weeks, but the gross came up blank." So, what's the cause of death? Essentially, it was cardiac arrest. But hell, everybody dies of cardiac or respiratory arrest if you want to get right down to it. The point is, there was no demonstrable organic heart disease, and no other natural findings that contributed to death. Technically, we have to list cause of death as undetermined. What's that mean, technically? I don't like the way you said that. She laughed. Good question. You're right. I have a hunch about this one, but I need to do some research. I've talked to the hospital librarian about tracking down an article I read a few years back. I don't know what made me think of it, but something about this situation rang a little bell. Like what? Can you fill me in? Not yet. I'm having my assistant set up some tissue slides that I can probably take a look at by this afternoon. I have 16 cases lined up before this one, but I'm curious. Do you need anything from me? I do have a suggestion, if you're open to this. I'm very interested in what happened to this woman during the hour she was missing. It would be a big help if you can find out where she was all that time. Well, I can try, I said, but it may turn out to be a trick. Am I looking for anything in particular? She had what looked like rope burns on her right wrist, torn and broken nails on her left. Oh, yeah, I saw that, I said, with sudden recollection. The knuckles on her left hand were scraped, too. Right. It's possible she was held someplace against her will. You might see if anybody has a potting shed or a greenhouse. I took some soil traces from her fingernails, and we might find a match. She also had superficial abrasions and contusions across her back. I saw a kid just last week with similar marks on his thighs and buttocks. He'd been beaten with a coat hanger, among other things.
Are you saying she was beaten?
Probably.
Does Lieutenant Dolan know about this?
He and the police photographer were both present for the post, so he saw the same things I did. The truth is, there was no internal trauma, and the injuries were too minor to be considered the cause of death.
What's your theory, then?
Uh-uh. Not till I do a bit of checking first. Call me this afternoon, or better yet, let me call you when I've seen what we've got here. By then you may have something to report yourself.
She hung up. I settled the receiver in the cradle and sat there, perplexed. Dietz was watching me. From my end of the conversation, he could tell there'd been a shift.
What's wrong?
Let's pick up your car and go by Irene's. I'd like to talk to Clyde.
I made a quick call to let them know we'd be stopping by, and then called a cab.
I detailed the situation on the way over to the hotel, Irene's carton in my lap.
When we reached the Edgewater, Dietz took his time with the Porsche, inspecting the engine and the electrical system. This wasn't the same car park attendant we'd dealt with the night before, and while the kid swore no one had been near the car, Dietz didn't want to trust him.
I doubt Messenger knows his ass from his elbow when it comes to bombs, but this is no time to be surprised, he said.
I waited while he stretched out on the driveway, inching partway under the car so he could scrutinize the underside. Evidently, there were no unidentified wires, no visible blasting caps, and no tidy bundles of dynamite. Satisfied, he got up and brushed himself off, then ushered me into the passenger seat. Dietz started the car and pulled out of the lot. For once, he drove slowly, his expression preoccupied.
"What are you chewing on?" I asked.
"I've been thinking about Messenger, and I wonder if it wouldn't be smart to talk to his ex-wife."
"Down in Los Angeles?"
"Or get her up here. We know he's got Eric with him, at least as of last night. She'd probably jump at the chance to get the kid back. Maybe we could help her, and she could turn around and help us."
"How?"
Dietz shrugged.
"I don't know yet, but it's better than doing nothing."
"You know how to get in touch with her?"
"I thought I'd drop you off and go talk to Dolan."
"Sounds good. Let's do that."
We parked in front of the Gersh's. Dietz held the carton for me while I extricated myself from the low-slung seat. When we reached the front porch, he left the carton by the door while I rang the bell. Our agreement was that I would wait here until he came back to pick me up.
"Make it fast," I murmured. "I don't want to be stuck with Irene all day." 45 minutes, max. Any longer I'll call. Be careful."
He backed me against the house with a kiss that made my toes curl, then gave a careless wave and moved off down the walk. Germaine opened the front door, stepping back to admit me as the Porsche ignition turned over and the car pulled away from the curb.
I was still collecting myself, trying to look like a sober private investigator, when in truth my drawers were wet. Germain and I made the proper mouth noises at one another. I could hear the telephone ring somewhere in the house. She heard it too, and raised her voice, as if projecting to the rear of an auditorium.
"I'll get it,"
she excused herself, waddling toward the kitchen with surprising grace. The house was otherwise silent, the living room veiled in shadow from the junipers along the property line. I crossed to one of the end tables and snapped on a lamp. I leaned sideways, peering through an archway to my left. Irene was sitting at a little desk in the solarium just off the living room. A small portable radio was playing classical music, and I assumed that's why she hadn't heard the front doorbell. She wore a bathrobe and slippers, looking worse than she had the night before. Her complexion, always pale, had taken on the tone of skin bleached by adhesive tape. It was clear she'd wept a good deal, and my guess was that she hadn't slept much. The false lashes were gone, and her eyes seemed puffy and remote. "Irene?" Startled, she looked up, her gaze searching the room for the source of the sound. When she caught sight of me, she pushed herself to her feet, using the desk for leverage. She came into the living room on shaky feet, hands held toward me like a toddler on a maiden voyage, making little mewing sounds as if every step hurt. She clung to me as she had before, but with an added note of desperation.
"Oh, Kinsey, thank goodness. I'm so glad you're here. Clyde had a meeting at the bank, but he said he'd be back as soon as he could make it."
"Good. I was hoping to talk to him. How are you?"
"Awful. I can't seem to get organized, and I can't bear to be alone."
I guided her toward the couch, struck by the sheer force of her neediness. "You don't look like you've slept much." She sank onto the couch, refusing to let go of my hands. She clutched at me like a drunk, sloppy with excess, grief perfuming her breath like alcohol.
"I sat down here most of the night so I wouldn't disturb Clyde. I don't know what to do. I've been trying to fill out Mother's death certificate, and I discover I don't know the first thing about her. I can't remember anything. It's inconceivable to me. So shameful, somehow. My own mother!"
She was beginning to weep again. "Hey, it's okay. This is something I can help you with." I held a hand up, palm toward her. "Just sit, relax. Is the form in there?" She seemed to collect herself. She nodded mutely, eyes fixed on me with gratitude as I moved into the adjacent room. I gathered up a pen and the 8x8-inch square form from the desk and returned to the couch, wondering how Clyde endured her dependency. Whatever compassion I felt was being overshadowed by the sense that I was shouldering a nearly impossible burden.
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
Chapter 20. "Treat this like a final exam," I said. "We'll do the easy questions first and then tackle the tough ones. Let's start with name of decedent. Did she have a middle name?" Irene shook her head.
"Not that I ever heard."
I wrote in, "Agnes, N.M.I., Gray." Irene and I sat with our heads bent together, meticulously filling in the meager information she had. This took a little over 1 minute and covered race, Caucasian, sex, female, military service, none, social security number, none, marital status, widowed, occupation, retired, and several subheadings under usual residence. What distressed Irene was that she didn't know the year of her mother's birth, and she didn't have a clue about where Agnes was born or the names of her parents. Fact, she felt anyone with an ounce of caring should have at her fingertips.
"Quit beating yourself, for God's sake," I said.
"Let's work backward and see how far we get. Maybe you know more than you think. For instance, everybody's been saying she was 83, right?" Irene nodded with uncertainty, probably wishing the form had a few multiple-choice questions. I could tell she was still agitated at the notion of her own ignorance. "Irene, you cannot flunk this test," I said. "I mean, what are they going to do, refuse to bury her?" I hated to be flip, but I thought it might snap her out of the self-pity. She said,
"I just don't want to get it wrong. It's important to do it right. It's the least I can do."
"I can understand that, but the world will not end if you leave one slot blank. We know she was a U.S. citizen, so let's put that down. The rest of the information we can pick up from your birth certificate. That would tell us your parents' place of birth and their ages the year you were born. Can you lay your hands on it? She nodded, blowing her nose on a handkerchief, which she then tucked in her robe pocket.
I'm almost sure it's in the file cabinet in there, she said.
She indicated the solarium, which she'd set up as a home office.
There's a folder in the top drawer labeled Vital Documents.
Don't get up. You stay here. I'll find it. I went into the next room and pulled open one of the file drawers. Vital Documents was a thick manila folder right in the front. I brought the entire file back and let Irene sort through the contents. She extracted a birth certificate, which she handed to me. I glanced at it briefly, then squinted more closely. This is a photocopy. What happened to the original?
I have no idea. That's the only one I ever had.
What about when you applied for a passport? You must have had a certified copy then.
I don't have a passport. I never needed one.
I stared at her, amazed. I thought I was the only person without a passport, I remarked. She seemed faintly defensive.
I don't like to travel. I was always afraid of getting ill and not having proper medical help available. If Clyde had to travel overseas on business, he went by himself. Is that a problem?
My guess was that she and Clyde had argued about her position more than once.
No, no. This will do, but it strikes me as odd. How'd you come by this one?
She closed her mouth and her cheeks flooded with pink, like a sudden restoration to good health. At first I thought she wouldn't answer me, but finally she pursed her lips.
Mother gave it to me when I was in high school. One of the more humiliating moments in my life with her. We were writing our autobiographies for an honors English class, and the teacher made us start with our birth certificates. I remember Mother had trouble finding mine, and I had to turn my report in without it. The teacher gave me an incomplete, the only one I ever got. Which just made Mother furious. It was awful. She brought it to school the next day and flung it in the teacher's face. She was drunk, of course. All my classmates looking on. It was one of the most embarrassing things I've ever been through.
I studied her with curiosity. What about your father? Where was he in all this?
I don't remember him. He and Mother separated when I was 3 or 4. He was killed in the war a few years later. 1943, I think.
I glanced down at the birth certificate, getting back to the task at hand. We'd really hit pay dirt. Irene was born in Brawley, March 12, 1936, at 2:30 a.m. Her father was Herbert Gray, birthplace Arizona, white, age 32, who worked as a welder for an aircraft company. Agnes's maiden name was Branwell, birthplace California, occupation housewife. This is great, I said, and then I read the next line. Oh, wait, this is weird. This says she was 23 when you were born, but that would make her, what, 70 now? That doesn't seem right.
That has to be a typo, she said, leaning closer.
She reached for the document and peered at the line of print as I had.
This is off by years. If Mother's 83 now, she would have been 36 when I was born, not 23.
Maybe she's much younger than we thought.
Not that much. She was nowhere near 70. You saw her yourself.
I thought about it briefly. Well, it doesn't make any difference as far as I can see.
Of course it does. One way or the other, we'd be off by 13 years.
I disconnected my temper. There was no point in being irritated.
We don't have any way to verify the information, I said.
At least that I can think of. Leave it blank.
I don't want to do that, she said stubbornly.
I'd seen her in this mood before, and I knew how unyielding she could be.
Do whatever suits. It's your business.
I heard a key in the lock. The front door opened and Clyde came in, dressed in his usual 3-piece suit. He was toting the cardboard carton I'd brought. He crossed to the couch, murmured a hello to me, and placed the box on the coffee table. Then he leaned over to kiss Irene's cheek, a ritualistic gesture without visible warmth.
This was on the front porch.
That's Irene's, I said. I found it under Agnes's trailer and had it shipped up. It arrived this morning. I pulled the box closer and opened the top flaps, reaching down among the nesting cups, which were still swaddled in newspaper. I wasn't sure if this was a good time or not, but these were just about the only things the squatters hadn't ripped off. I unwrapped one of the teacups and passed it over to Irene. The porcelain handle had a hairline crack near the base, but otherwise it was perfect. pale pink roses, hand-painted on a field of white, scaled down to child size. Irene glanced at it without comprehension, and then something flickered in her face. A sound seemed to rumble up from the depths of her being. With a sudden cry of revulsion, she flung it away from her. Fear shot through me in reaction to hers. Clyde and I both jumped, and I uttered an automatic chirp of astonishment. Her scream tore through the air in a spiraling melody of terror. As if in slow motion, the cup bounced once against the edge of the coffee table and cracked as neatly in two as if it had been cut with a knife. Irene rose to her feet, her eyes enormous. She was hyperventilating. Rapid, shallow breathing that couldn't possibly be delivering enough oxygen to her system. I could see her begin to topple, eyes focused on my face. She clawed at me as she fell, pitching forward in a convulsion that rocked her from head to toe. Clyde grabbed her as she went down, moving faster than I thought possible. He eased her back onto the couch and elevated her feet. Germaine thundered into the living room, a dish towel in her hand. Her eyes were wide with alarm.
"What's the matter? What's happening? Oh, my God!"
Irene's eyes had rolled back in her head, and she jerked repeatedly, racked by some personal earthquake that sent shockwaves through her small frame. The acrid scent of urine permeated the air. Clyde peeled his jacket off and went down on his knees beside her, trying to restrain her so she wouldn't hurt herself. Germaine stood by, spellbound, twisting the dish towel in her big dark hands, making anxious sounds at the back of her throat. Gradually the spasm passed. Irene began to cough, a tight, unproductive sound that made me ache in response. The cough was followed by a high-pitched wheeze that helped to mobilize me again. I put a supporting hand under Irene's right arm and shot Clyde a look. "Let's sit her upright. It'll make her breathing easier." We hefted her into a sitting position, a surprisingly awkward maneuver given how light she was. She couldn't have weighed more than 100 pounds, but she was limp and dazed, her eyes moving from face to face without comprehension. It was clear she had no idea where she was or what was going on.
"You want I should call emergency, Mr. Clyde?"
Germaine asked.
"Not yet. Let's hold off on that. She seems to be coming around," he said.
A fine layer of perspiration broke out on Irene's face. She reached for me blindly. Her hands had that clammy feel to them, like a still-animated fish in the bottom of a boat. Germaine disappeared and returned moments later with a cold, damp rag that she passed wordlessly to Clyde. He wiped Irene's face. She'd begun to make small sounds, a weeping, hopeless and childlike, as if she were waking from a nightmare of devastating impact.
"There were spiders. I could smell the dust."
Clyde looked at me.
"She's always been phobic about spiders."
I picked up the two halves of the teacup automatically, wondering if she'd seen something in the bottom. I half expected one of those old dead spiders lying on its back, legs curled in against its belly like a blossom closing up at twilight. There was nothing. Meanwhile, Irene was inconsolable.
"The paint ran down the wall in horrible streaks. The violets were ruined, and I was so scared. I didn't mean to be bad."
Clyde made soothing noises while he patted her hand.
"Irene, you're okay. It's fine now. I'm right here."
The look in her eyes was pleading, her voice reduced to a plaintive whisper.
"It was Mother's tea set from when she was little. I wasn't supposed to play with it. I hid so I wouldn't get spanked and spanked. Why did she keep it?"
"I'm putting her to bed," he said.
He eased one arm under her bent knees, put the other behind her, and lifted, not without some effort. He inched away from the coffee table, walking sideways till he was clear. And then he headed toward the stairs. Germaine accompanied him, hovering close by to help steady the load. I sank down on the couch and put my head in my hands. My heart rate was beginning to return to normal, no mean feat given the rush of adrenaline I'd experienced. Other people's fear is contagious, a phenomenon magnified by proximity, which is why horror movies are so potent in a crowded theater. I smelled death, some terrifying experience neither Irene nor Agnes could deal with all these years afterward. I could only guess at the dimensions of the event. Now that Agnes was dead, I doubted the reality would ever be resurrected. I stirred restlessly, glancing at my watch. I'd been here only 30 minutes. Surely Dietz would return soon and get me the hell out of here.
I leafed through a magazine that was sitting on the coffee table. At the back of the issue, there was a whole month's worth of dinner menus laid out, totally nutritious, well-balanced meals for mere pennies a serving. The recipes sounded awful. Lots of tuna surprise and tofu stir-fry with sweet and sour sauce. I set the magazine aside. Idly, I picked up the halves of the teacup, rewrapped them in newspaper, and tucked them back in the box. I got up and crossed the room, setting the box by the door. No point in having Irene face that again. Later, if she was interested. I could always bring it back. I looked up to find Clyde coming wearily down the stairs. Chapter 21. He looked like a zombie. I followed as he crossed to one of two matching wing chairs and took a seat. He rubbed his eyes, then pinched the bridge of his nose. His dress shirt was wrinkled, the tiny blue pinstripe stained with sweat at the armpits. I gave her a Valium. Germaine said she'd stay with her until she goes to sleep. I stayed on my feet, clinging to whatever psychological advantage I had in towering over him. What's going on, Clyde? I've never seen anyone react like that. Irene's a sick cookie. She has been ever since we met. He snorted to himself. God, I used to think there was something charming about her helplessness. This goes way beyond helpless. That woman's terrified. So was Agnes. It's always been like that. She's phobic about everything. Closed spaces, spiders, dust. You know what she's afraid of? The hook and eye on a door. She's afraid of African violets. Jesus, violets! And it just gets worse. She suffers from allergies, depression, hypochondria. She's half dead from fear and probably hooked on all the prescription drugs she takes. I've taken her to every kind of doctor you can name, and they all throw up their hands. The shrinks love to see her coming, but then they lose interest when the old voodoo doesn't work. She doesn't want to get better, trust me. She's hanging on to her symptoms for dear life. I try to have compassion, but all I feel is despair. My life is a nightmare, but what am I supposed to do, divorce her? I can't do it. I couldn't live with myself if I did that. She's like a little kid. I thought when her mother died, I thought once Agnes was gone, she'd improve, like a curse being lifted. But it won't happen that way.
Do you have any idea what it is?
He shook his head. He had the hopeless air of a rat being badgered by a cat. What about her father? Could this be connected to him? She says he died in the war.
Your guess is as good as mine, he said, smiling wistfully. Irene probably married me because of him.
Wanting a father?
Oh, sure, wanting everything. Comfort, protection, security.
You know what I want?
I want to live 1 week without drama.